Paul. On September 17, 1775, Continental Army volunteers in Newburyport, Massachusetts, preparing for a campaign against Quebec, attended Sunday services at the town's First Presbyterian Church. First Presbyterian held the final resting place of George Whitefield, the key preacher in the First Great Awakening of the 1740s, who had died in Newburyport on his last visit to America in 1770. After a military procession, the troop's chaplain preached to the assembly, and then some of the officers went down to the crypt and opened Whitefield's tomb. From Whitefield's decaying body, the men took pieces of his clothes, including his clerical collar and wristbands. Apparently, they hoped that these relics from an evangelical saint would help them win the battle before them. But unfortunately, it didn't work. The mission to Quebec led to a grievous defeat. In this memorable way, the Continental officers made a connection between evangelical Christianity, the Great Awakening, and the American Revolution. The temptation to link the Great Awakening and the American Revolution seems almost irresistible. The Great Awakening was a series of religious revivals that crested in the early 1740s, led by preachers such as Whitefield and Jonathan Edwards. The Great Awakening transformed the nature of American religion. For thousands of American colonists, the unprecedented revivals focused their attention on the all-important question, have I experienced the new birth of salvation through Jesus Christ? This radically individualistic spiritual focus made people behave in socially individualistic ways too, leading many evangelicals to abandon the established state churches for new, ostensibly purer churches fully devoted to revivalism. The Great Awakening signaled the beginning of the evangelical Christian movement in America. Many scholars have attempted to link the evangelical movement to the American Revolution. Historian Alan Heimert argued in Religion in the American Mind, 1966, that Protestant liberalism made its devotees reluctant revolutionaries, while evangelical Calvinism lay at the heart of the, quote, radical, even democratic, social and political ideology that powered the revolution. Now, many have rejected his point about liberalism. Liberals crossed the revolutionary spectrum, and many of the most visible patriot leaders, of course, were theological liberals. But others have agreed that there was a remarkable affinity among evangelicals for the patriot cause. Yet a direct connection between the two movements remains elusive. Certainly many patriots embraced an evangelical faith, but many did not, as seen most obviously in the case of founding fathers like Washington, Madison, Franklin, and Jefferson. Evangelicals that became patriots did not necessarily become patriots because they were evangelicals. But it appears that the majority of evangelicals from Maine to Georgia, but clearly not in Nova Scotia, where there was a very lively evangelical loyalist community, the majority of American evangelicals were patriots. Nevertheless, evangelicalism helped breed an egalitarian spirit, an emphasis on individual religious experience and the power of the common people that helped feed a deep social transformation, that revolution in hearts and minds accompanying the military and political rebellion. Some historians have argued that evangelicalism gave the revolution one of its most potent ideological resources. Evangelicalism, as this line of thinking goes, taught the common people who embraced it that sometimes they must, quote, take matters into their own hands, a subversive tendency which exploded during the imperial crisis. The church separations and disruptions of the revivals have been identified as a, quote, practice model, which enabled the provincials to rehearse, though unwittingly, the arguments that would reappear with the political crisis of the 1760s and 70s. Although I am sympathetic to such arguments, it remains difficult to demonstrate them except by inference. Early evangelicalism, especially in its radical manifestations, was both spiritually and socially subversive and was perceived as a grievous threat to social and ecclesiastical order. The evangelical revivals caused the greatest social upheaval of any movement in the colonies prior to the revolution. So this massive defiance of traditional authority must have exercised some shaping influence on the revolution. But what precisely was in the nature of that influence? Well, evangelical faith clearly shaped many patriots' views, giving them a framing vocabulary through which to discuss the imperial crisis. Patriots routinely called Americans back to moral virtuousness and implied that the revolution had quasi-millennial significance. Evangelicals also lent widespread credibility to Republican ideology, ideas that propelled the revolution. American evangelicals embraced the Republican fear of abuses from illegitimate power and a nearly messianic belief in the benefits of liberty. Though Republicanism had often joined historically with humanism and religious skepticism, evangelicals in America found Republican ideals utterly congenial. Some patriots directly linked Christianity and Republicanism, as Philadelphia physician Benjamin Rush wrote to Baptist minister Elhanan Winchester in 1791 that, quote, Republican forms of government are the best repositories for the gospel. Evangelicals championed Republicanism as eagerly as their more liberal or skeptical patriot friends. Some notable non-evangelical patriots were also shaped by evangelical rhetoric and ideals. Indeed, much of evangelicalism's power lay in its rhetoric. Itinerants led by George Whitefield gathered audiences of people they did not know and spoke in everyday language filled with biblical allusions to reach those people. And many of the leading patriots also mobilized the people at large in the revolutionary cause by giving simple speeches in everyday language. The informality and anonymity of these sermons and speeches rejected older norms of hierarchy by implicitly endorsing the right of common people to hear, evaluate, and respond to unregulated addresses. Now, certainly the patriot assemblies were less participatory, democratic, and inclusive than were many evangelical meetings, but one still sees similarities between them, especially in the public tactics used by patriot leaders such as Virginia's Patrick Henry. The power behind Patrick Henry's famous speaking ability lay in his popular homespun style that was often peppered with biblical references. Henry, an Anglican, successfully used the evangelical rhetorical style in revolutionary politics. As a teenager, Henry had often listened to evangelical Virginian sermons, like those of Presbyterian Samuel Davies. Henry's uncle and namesake, the Anglican priest Patrick Henry, feuded incessantly with Presbyterians in Davies, Hanover County, Virginia. On Patrick Henry the nephew, however, the Presbyterian style made a more favorable impression. Henry reportedly called Davies, quote, the greatest orator he had ever heard. Some acquaintances reckoned that Henry spoke like an evangelical minister and that, quote, his figures of speech were often borrowed from the scriptures. A close examination of Henry's 1775 liberty or death speech has shown that it's full of biblical phrases, particularly from the prophet Jeremiah. Calling resistance against the British government the, quote, holy cause of liberty, Henry insisted that, quote, gentlemen may cry peace, peace, but there is no peace. Jeremiah 6:14, almost verbatim. An early biographer remembered that at the famous final line of the speech, Henry lifted his arms and bellowed like the patriarch Joshua, I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death. And this was Henry, the evangelist for independence, at his finest rhetorical moment. With regard to the theme of this meeting, the contested roots of American liberty, the clearest political influence that many evangelicals exercised in the founding period was the fight for disestablishment of state churches. From South Carolina to Virginia and Massachusetts, evangelicals heavily influenced by or converted in the Great Awakening worked for years to disestablish the colony state churches, either Anglican or Congregational. Many of those dissenting evangelicals, especially radical Baptists, had faced persecution, fines, and even imprisonment by hostile colonial authorities, and they saw the revolution as a great opportunity to win full freedom to practice their revivalist faith with no government interference. In a union that we might struggle to conceive of today, given the current state of politics, evangelicals and skeptical deists often fought together in battles against establishmentarian Protestants. For instance, Thomas Jefferson, who was famously skeptical about Christianity, the liberal Episcopalian James Madison and evangelical Baptists labored together to win religious freedom in Virginia that came in 1786. Jefferson and Madison wanted no punishments for those holding heterodox beliefs, while the Baptists wanted no punishments for those finding the established Anglican churches wanting in Christian devotion. In a lesser known example, South Carolina's evangelical Presbyterian minister, William Tennant III, a member of the state legislature, campaigned early in the Revolution to end state support for the Anglican Church. Though Tennant was thoroughly committed to American independence, he also saw in the Revolution a great opportunity for disestablishment. Thus, the fiery patriot, as some had begun calling Tennant, drafted a petition calling for disestablishment of the Anglican Church and presented it to the Assembly in early 1777. With the onset of the colonists' rebellion, he argued, quote, "Government has returned to its just and natural source, and a constitution is framing with a view to perpetuate the freedom and quiet of the good people of this state. Since religious freedom was, quote, the most valuable of all liberty, the new state constitution would surely guarantee it. Tennant cried that equality or nothing ought to be our motto. In short, every plan of establishment must operate as a plan of injustice and oppression." And he called on the Assembly to, quote, "yield to the mighty current of American freedom and glory." And they did so as the legislature passed the petition and disestablished the Anglican Church. The longest-running battle for disestablishment, however, was fought in New England by Isaac Backus and the Baptists. Backus had been converted during the First Great Awakening and soon joined an illegal separate congregation in Connecticut. Then, despite his lack of college education, he became a pastor over a separate congregation in Massachusetts. And finally, in the 1750s, he became a Baptist, meaning that he rejected the practice of infant baptism, unlike most Anglo-American Protestants. For setting up separate and Baptist churches, Backus and his followers faced threats, fines, and even occasional imprisonment from the New England colonial governments. Backus began his campaign for the rights of religious dissenters in 1749, when he and other separates protested against a local tax requiring separates to help pay for a new congregational meeting house. Their petition was rejected by the Massachusetts General Court. Backus suffered quietly under this kind of taxation until the late 1760s, when he began publishing tracts advocating the termination of the state-supported establishment. His key text on the subject was an appeal to the public for religious liberty against the oppressions of the present day, 1773. In it, Backus argued that God clearly intended to separate civil and ecclesiastical governments in contrast to the frame of the Massachusetts government. Quote, "Who can hear Christ declare that his kingdom is not of this world and yet believe that this blending of church and state together can be pleasing to him?" He cleverly linked the Baptist cause to the patriots, arguing that to deny the one while supporting the other was hypocritical. No American should expect that God, quote, "will turn the heart of our earthly sovereign to hear the pleas for liberty of those who will not hear the cries of their fellow subjects under their oppressions." The colonists complained of taxation without representation, yet, quote, "is it not really so with us? Did not the Baptists have to support ecclesiastical governments in which they had no voice?" The Baptists of Massachusetts arranged for a copy of an appeal to the public to be distributed to every member of the First Continental Congress. Backus decided to take his case directly to Congress, as little help seemed to be forthcoming from the Massachusetts legislature. Backus and his colleagues met with the Massachusetts delegates in Philadelphia and presented their grievances. John and Samuel Adams both responded with long speeches in which they argued that, quote, "there is indeed an ecclesiastical establishment in our province, but a very slender one, hardly to be called an establishment." The meeting went downhill from there, with Samuel Adams suggesting that the outlandish complaints, quote, "came from enthusiasts who had made a merit of suffering persecution, and also that enemies to these colonies had a hand therein." The Massachusetts delegates pointed out that the Baptists needed only to file certificates of tax exemption for dissenters, but Backus insisted that the often abused certificates also represented a violation of free conscience. The Massachusetts delegates ended the session by offering to bring the grievances to the Massachusetts Assembly. But John Adams still cautioned that, quote, we might as well expect a change in the solar system as to expect they would give up their establishment. He was right. Massachusetts didn't fully abandon its state support for the Congregational Church until 1833. It would be unsupportable to argue that the Great Awakening directly caused the American Revolution. Nevertheless, the evangelical faith that emerged in the 1740s clearly colored the struggle for American liberty in several ways. First, it gave many patriots a framing vocabulary to describe their fight in transcendent terms. It endowed Republican thought with a new Christian gloss, which made it more palatable to thousands of Americans. Evangelicalism supplied patriots like Patrick Henry with a new populist rhetorical style that mobilized the people at large, many of whom had been similarly touched by the sermons of the revival meetings. Finally, and most directly, the Great Awakening began to break down the authority of religious establishments in America and created momentum for a government that would still support a general Christian morality, but not preference one denomination over another. This establishment set the stage for an explosion of evangelical piety, especially among the Baptists and Methodists, that by the Civil War had turned America into a heavily evangelical nation. Even today, America's disproportionately evangelical church adherence, in contrast to Western Europe's, and comparatively high standard of religious freedom, can be attributed directly to the ironic genius of disestablishment. Thank you.